Welcome to the Driving Eureka podcast, where we share ideas and advice for helping you find, filter, and fast track big ideas. Let's go! Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt, advisor to global organizations on the Deming philosophy and host of the Deming Institute podcast.
And I'm Doug Hall, inventor, speaker, teacher, and whiskey maker. I'm also the founder of the Eureka Ranch and author of the Driving Eureka book.
This is the 12th episode of the Driving Eureka podcast. This episode is a discussion of Doug Hall's newsletter available at doughall.com. You can click on the menu, newsletters, and you can sign up for his weekly newsletter. The feature article this week is Thinkers and Doers Must Work Together or Will All Fail Spectacularly. And this week's Driving Eureka book segment is about leveraging diversity, and the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy is the importance of bringing together the thinkers and doers in a whiskey distillery. Our craft cocktail recipe is the Boulevard Cocktail. So, Doug, we've got a theme this week talking about thinkers and doers. And when I first read this piece, I was thinking, okay, we've got the thinkers over here, and then we got the doers, and never the two shall meet. And maybe that's just the way that it plays out.
It seems to be. I mean, and we can sadly, we see this over in the UK with Brexit and the US with Congress and all the rest of the stuff. It's like we have this desire, I think, to create checks and balances. In a sense that if we have checks and balances and people are just battling with each other, that will save us from anybody being stupid. Maybe. I think Franklin had it right. We must all hang together, or most assuredly we'll all hang separately, as Ben Franklin said. And this was inspired. I went for a walk. I was in Prince Edward Island over the holidays, and where we have a farmhouse there. And I was walking the shore of New London Bay, and it hit me that – so much of organizations can be split into, and for whatever reason, and I'm stereotyping, and so it's not exactly like this, but I'm going to exaggerate for effect. But there are people that think the great thoughts, and the people that actually do the work. You know, the marketing people tend to think the big thoughts about the product, and then the salespeople actually have to go, you know, face to face with the customers and sell it to them, whether it's industrial or consumer or whatever it is. There's the engineering people that do the designs of the equipment, and then the production people who actually have to make it work. I was told a story by one large manufacturing company, a very famous one. They said, the problem we've got is our engineering department creates stuff. They put it into the plant. They come back a month later, and the plant has rebuilt it so to make it work. And I go, so what's the problem? They said, well, engineering's mad about it. Well, I said, then engineering should design it right the first time. you know? And so we've got this divergence between these, and our idea is we have Henry Ford in our head that you have your task, just do your job. Mm. And you know, then the next person does theirs, and you hand your work to the next person. And it's these handoffs from department to department that creates at least half the failure of new ideas. Because the success rate of innovations for large companies is about 5%. And at least half this comes from these handoffs, because we just have to figure out a way to make it happen. Now, there's some false cures for this that makes management feel good. They go, oh, no, that's not a problem. I've taken care of that. We have the thinker team have representatives from the doer team. We have a representative on sales there. Well, the problem is that person's usually such a low-level person. They don't have the understanding or authority or the seniority to say no when something's being unrealistic. And if when they say there's a problem, they say, you're not being a team player, just buck up. Mm. It's like this buck up and this stupid, you know? And the second way that management says we do, oh, no, I've taken care of that. I have my thinkers do a walkthrough. They've walked through the plant or they've driven along with a salesperson. When did they do that? Well, 10 years ago when they started. Okay, nothing's changed in 10 years. I mean, hello. You know, and sadly, most thinkers think they're so intellectually superior that they get it. They already know it, and they don't. The world's different. And the third way they try to do it is they say, well, if we just do more planning, and this is it's called waterfall, where you plan the whole thing and then you just give it to the folks. The reality is there's so much complexity in today's world and how people are going to react, especially to new ideas, that just doesn't work. So the solution to this thinker-doer divide is really simple. Big companies are 5% success rate with innovations. Small companies have a 50% are still in business after 3 years. That's better. 55. And part of the reason why it's the case is because at small companies, the silos are not, if they are there at all, they're not very rigid. And the CEO has line of sight to everybody. And everybody is much more engaged in all of the elements. There's joint ownership on the mission. See, at the big co, they're more interested in their silo than the organization. At the small company, it's the organization that matters. And so that brings them together much, much more. And so it's that collaboration that we need to bring, which is what we do. And I talk about in the book is how to bring teams together under a common mission. What's the mission? What's the innovation project mission, the blue card? And then bringing them together with software that brings them together, and then giving them tools to be able to quantify and to test and experiment so that they come together as a team where everybody is sharing in everything. There's product people writing marketing ideas, finding ideas for products. We are a team as opposed to a collection of individuals.
So Doug, are you trying to recreate then within a large organization what a small organization would operate as?
Yeah, if I could have my own way, I just get rid of all the departments. Same thing at universities. I get rid of all the colleges. That's half the problem. Just break them down. Now, the fact is that, and then be dotted line to the department and solid line to the business. Right now, we got it reversed. The solid line to the department and dotted line to the business. It's all messed up. Doesn't work.
And so what in essence is the process then of doing that? I guess I'm trying to visualize in my head how you're breaking this down.
So what we're going to do is instead of having a mission that's focused on your silo, product development, sales, marketing, we're going to have a mission that is more important than your departmental mission. How we're going to change the world of whiskey, how we're going to change the world of hotels, how we're going to change the world of mooring systems for deep water oil rigs. What is the mission and why is that important to people? And that's going to overcome the departmentalists. We need something bigger than ourselves. And see, this happens at companies when they're going out of business. When they're going out of business, suddenly departments disappear and the corporate mission becomes the mission. We've all been through situations where we've been in something that's a bad situation. Everybody comes together quickly. Well, it's the same thing here. That's what we're looking to do. It's the same thing.
But sometimes they come together quickly and it's too late. Right.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. It's just too late. It's just too late.
And are there recognizable, I don't know, when you talk to organizations, what are the characteristics of those that have, come to see the light too late?
Well, there's usually a history of letting people go. One thing I know is I say, well, let's run a survey to see their attitudes towards innovation. They say, no, we don't do any surveys anymore. I go, why you don't? Well, they always come up bad. So the CEO said, stop surveying people. Well, that's helpful. That's helpful. And the problem is what you end up with first is adverse selection. So the people that are great bolt because they have options. And so the people you're left with not so good. Not always the case. There'll be some that will believe in the mission of the organization and they'll stay. So to be clear, there'll be some that will stay. But as a general rule, you know, point for point, it becomes pretty painful.
So let's just play this out a little bit. We got a scenario even as we speak. You've got Sears, right? They've been closing stores month over month. They're, you know, letting people go. They're closing these stores. You know, it's funny. It kind of reminds me of the Iacocca book, Lee Iacocca, you know, when he was at, first Ford and then later Chrysler. But, you know, he would have what he would call the bean counters would all come to him and say, look, you know, I know we're closing two plants, but we need to close, you know, and then Iacocca would interrupt and basically say, well, we need to close them all because they're all losing money. You know, if we go into it with that attitude, you know, we're just going to close everything down. And I almost see this kind of playing out. So when you look at something like Sears, you know, I mean, here's a name that's been around forever. Literally, they made retail. And you're looking at an organization like this that, you know, the layoffs have been happening. I don't know what they do on surveys, but what would be your advice to them? When you look at it, and I know you don't know the details of it, but where would you begin with a company like that?
Well, and so there's other elements going on with the Sears situation in that you've got an investment bank that owns the thing. And the truth of the matter is that they're getting all their money out because they're selling off they've sold off real estate and leased it back and they've done all kinds of games already. Mm. And so you don't have owner operator. You know, you've got, you know, money changers and the things in play that's happening. So what the challenge is I don't know that there is a way to save Sears. Mm. I don't know that anybody cares about saving Sears except for maybe the employees and those communities that do it, because you don't have somebody up there who have what Deming would talk about is constancy of purpose, the long-term survival of the organization. The actions taken, selling off their best brands, selling off the real estate, you know, what needed to happen was 10 or 15 years ago, they needed to start three or four experiments to reinvent them. I mean, this is the company that was the Amazon of the world. Mm. They're the original Amazon. Remember the big Christmas gift book? If it wasn't in the Sears catalog, you didn't need it. This is the original Amazon, for crying out loud.
Yep.
They were it. Now, is it hard to change? Yes, it's hard to change. Get over it. That's why you're the big boss, numbnuts. That's your job. And so they needed to see the future. They need to see the things that are going. But now they're so far behind, I just don't know that it's, you know, you got to confront the reality. What does this thing become in its new life? And why does it need to exist? You got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them. And I hate to be negative, but you know, I don't know enough. I mean, I tangentially was involved in some conversations with people about Craftsman and different things. And I can't get into specifics, but who's leading? Where are we going? That's the key. Okay. Where are we going? What's your vision for where this is going
to
be?
Okay. So this goes to a common theme we've talked about in previous episodes, which is, you know, the time to innovate is now, not once somebody has already disrupted you.
Yeah, because now you don't have any energy.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't have resources.
Well, and then it also feeds into some of the data that you've talked about before too, that, you know, you got to be the first to market, you know, where it's, and it is, there is a prevailing thinking that exists in the marketplace about the fact that you don't want to be the first to market.
Right. And those people that say that, I mean, just, I got a book. It's called Jumpstart Your Marketing Brain or Meaningful Marketing in Hardcover. And I cite in 100 years of research on this. And they'll say, well, I saw this thing that happened. I saw this thing that happened. No, the data says that to the pioneer goes the reward. And do pioneers fail? Yes. Do followers fail? Yes. But when you look at it all, if you want to play the odds, the odds are you're going to make more money if you're the pioneer and not the follower. Okay. By a lot, by like a factor of 2 to 3 to 5.
Right.
Okay. That's the truth. Now you say, well, no, that's a case. I know of a case. I go, yeah, I know. And I know somebody that bought a lottery ticket by standing on one foot and patting on their head, but that doesn't make it a system. You know, it's ridiculous. Random events happen. The question is how do you make more money? You got to pioneer. And if you're not unique, you better be cheap. Yeah. And so you've got to pioneer. And by the time you know you have to do, I mean, I've been at companies where they say, well, we've tried everything else. We've fired all the people. We've changed everything. We've cost cut. I guess we're going to have to innovate. Well, for crying out loud, that's not the attitude. You know, guess what? It's too late. Mm. It's probably too late. Now, with superhuman effort, you can do it. If you can buy yourself some time, you can do it. But you're going to have to double down and triple down. And the fact is, there will still be people who still believe in the organization. It amazes me. There'll still be people who care, and they can be activated. You ask for volunteers, you put together a team. In our case, we'll oftentimes do Eureka Inventing, so we accelerate it even faster than with innovation engineering, because they just need to get – they have to show they can win quickly. They got to show they can win quickly.
Yeah. So you basically, you know, you look at Sears, they're out of time and money. I mean, that's right. That seems to be kind of where I guess they would place. Okay. All right.
The game's well, over.
Yeah,
the
yeah,
game's
yeah.
over.
Yeah. That's and yet it's unfortunate, but it can be a good lesson, you know, to other organizations too. But we seem to be learning the same lesson over and over and over again, which is the problem that we're trying to mitigate.
Yeah, and just so that we're clear, Tripp, I've made the mistake over 35 years of having Eureka Ranch. I've made a mistake where I got fat, dumb, and happy, and we stayed with where we were, and we didn't reinvent it. Our Eureka Inventing is on its, like, eighth or ninth version now. But I had times when we were making a lot of money, business was great, and I just said, we're good, and I didn't reinvest in it. Right now, this year, we made the biggest investment in the history of the company. Biggest investment in the history of the company in reinventing our education, our software, our methods, and our tools. Biggest ever. And so it's the best of times right now. It feels good having that. When you don't have it, that's really stinks.
Yeah. And as you said, the data plays it out that you need to be the pioneer, that you need to be the one leading this. Okay.
And that's a perfect segue to our book excerpt.
It's time now for the Driving Eureka book segment with author and inventor Doug Hall. Leveraging diversity. And how does this fit in then with this whole thinkers and doers concept?
Well, big picture, what we're talking about is diversity and collaboration. And you know, when we say diversity, we think it's like standing in a circle and singing We Are the World. Great song, but not the answer. It's about constructive dialogue, debate, where people from different views come together to create something great. It's what created, I mean, the U.S. was created by a whole bunch of immigrants, my mother's being a first-generation immigrant. A whole bunch of immigrants came to this country from different beliefs and different structures and different views, and together they created this new thing, this new thing in Philadelphia. And it was a bunch of different people. It wasn't a monoculture. It was a diverse culture. People said, it's not really a melting pot. It's really more like a salad bowl. Melting pot means they go in and they all become the same. A salad bowl, you still have the onions, the radishes, the cucumbers. You know, they retain their individuality, but together they create something wonderful in this wonderful salad. So it's about leveraging diversity. And the numbers, just connecting to what we just talked about, and what I write in the newsletter here is I took an excerpt from the Driving Eureka book. Diversity is not additive. It's not multiplicative, you know, 2 times 2. It's exponential. And literally, the impact of diversity is exponential. And I give the example, you know, if you have stimulus mining is 2 and diversity is 1, 2 raised to the 1 power is a 2. If you double the stimulus to a 4 and diversity stays 1, you now got a 4. But if you take the 4 of stimulus mining and take diversity to a 6, you get over 4,000 ideas. And that's the kind of impact we're talking about. That's the impact we're talking about when we bring together people. But it takes patience and courage to put up with. It's not for wimps. It means people that disagree with you. You know, my problem at the Eureka Ranch is I heard all these independent thinkers who think differently, and they keep doing it. And sometimes I say to them, I say, you know, in the old days, this was a lot nicer. Everybody just did what I said. Now, I smile when I say it. But the fact of the matter is, you know, was it Drucker or somebody said, we hire all these bright people, and then we encourage them to not think anymore. I mean, what the hell's going on? I mean, it's crazy. I may have that wrong, but it's you get the idea.
Right, right. So give me your operational definition of what diversity looks like. What does that mean? I mean, that can mean, you know, politically it means something. You know, what does it mean in the innovation world?
Well, it's interesting because we've been in a debate with this because it means departmental differences. You went to an engineering school, you went to a business school, you went to a finance school. Okay, got it, whatever. It means knowledge basis difference. It's silos of departments that are different. And yes, it's age and sex and race. Yes. I remember sitting with a company in Mexico, all men, all macho men in the room, and they sold products. This happened to be consumer products. It was an industrial company I was working with and a consumer products at the same time in Monterrey, Mexico. And I walked in and I said, who do you sell your products to? They said, oh, women. I said, all women? They go, all women. I said, man, you guys must be really good. They said, what do you mean? I said, I'd like to get some advice from you. They said, well, what do you mean? I said, all of you guys understand women so good. You don't need to have a woman in leadership. You know everything about how women work. Can you teach me a little? And they didn't. They laughed, but politely. But they got the point. You know, whatever. Yeah, get over it. The fact of the matter is that there are all these others, but the one that I think is the most powerful, and people at my office, they disagree with me on this, because they think in particular that the most actionable one that's the difference is getting the thinkers and doers to work together. That's the thing, and there's some truth to that for the short term wins is to get these people to not just put up with each other, but to truly be a team where you're willing to sacrifice for your side. Sales is willing to sacrifice for marketing, or marketing is willing to sacrifice for sales. That their job becomes harder to make the other person better, but for the whole to win. I think that long term, the bigger difference is cultural differences from different countries. In my life, what I found is when I'm sitting and working in Asia or working in Europe or wherever it might be, South America, the cultural differences, which is not just age, sex, and race, but it's a whole world view that's different. I mean, just looks at the world in a whole different way. To me, that gives me more richness than anything else when they have a complete mindset that's different. And that comes from these different countries, which is what created America. And it's fundamental. It's the driver behind the immigrant program in Canada. It's these different cultures coming together that just has a richness to it. It may not be short term, but long term, I think that's what really grows.
And how did you conclude that? How did you get there? What life experiences? What has led you to say that it's cultural diversity that's the most important one to, you know,
for the long term? It came from my dad. It really came from my dad. My dad had worked with Deming, and then he did licensing of carbonless paper technology to Asia, Europe, South America. And I spent a lot of time talking to my dad, and then he took us. In fact, I remember going to Yugoslavia, way, way back when it was Yugoslavia still, and spending time with the folks that he'd worked with there. And he would just teach me about how much he learned from these different ways, you know, being in Mexico with the workers. And my dad was fiercely conservative. But at the same time, he could just see the people and what he learned from the people. And it's amazing. When it came to work, he was incredibly liberal. I mean, he was the same guy, politically conservative, but you'd think the way he would talk about the workers and how much he could learn from these people that he was a total liberal. It just struck me. And then, you know, he taught me how to, you know, when you're at these places, he says, when you land in Europe, he says, the first thing you do is just you fly overnight. He says, get out and start walking the streets and stop into the local coffee house or pub or whatever the time is, and just start talking to people and start to feel what people are saying and doing. And I've done the same thing. When I flew to Korea, I set up, we had a partner there, a licensed partner for the Eureka Ranch there. And he set up his daughter, who's in college, to take me on a tour and around. And we saw it, and I met with her friends, and I got to get a sense. And it just gave me a worldview that was different that helped me when I led the session that I was leading over there. And I do the same thing other places. It's like you've got to come in and don't put your view on it, but come in and learn from the people how they're looking at the world, their values, their trade-offs, what's worth things, money to them, what's not worth money to them, what are their dreams, their aspirations. And it just, you know, the challenge we got is, what is it, like 30 or 40% of Americans have a passport. So most have never been out of the country.
Right.
And so, you know, again, it's what we've talked, as Deming would say, how could they know the importance of international if you've never been there?
Right.
If you've never been there, I'm not going to throw stones. I'm not. And if you've traveled, you've seen, I remember sitting in Paris once, and my wife and I, we were in a cafe in Paris, and Paris is Paris. And this, you know, what we would be called an ugly American Texan with a big hat comes in, and I'm not throwing Texas under the bus, but he was. And he gave a lecture on how they do it in America, and you could just sense the stupidity of this. It was like, dude, and are you getting anything from this? Are you learning? If you should have stayed in frickin' Texas. If you want to be Texas, be in Texas. Here we're having this elegant food that is spectacular in this incredible romantic place, and you're mad because you didn't get your steak big enough. I mean, dude, get over it. You know, yeah. Let me tell you ordered the wrong freaking thing.
So
I'm sorry. I just, I'm thinking that it just gets me. There's nothing that gets me.
You're not more. Learning. You're in essence just imposing.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah. So, in this book segment, you put in the math and you put in the meaningful uniqueness equals the stimulus to the power of diversity.
That's right.
With the denominator being, you know, driving out fear, which we've touched on before too. But the thing you say it's experiential, and yet I know you as kind of a researcher. Is there any research that's been done on in association with the diversity, or is it all just your life experience?
No, there's quite a bit. So one of the things we measured was we had all these teams. We had thousands of teams that came through the ranch, and we measured the teams at the moment of creation. And thank you for bringing this up, because this is actually based on fact. And I skipped right over it because I'm just, well, I just skipped.
Because you have life experiences.
So what happened is Dr. Chris Storman and I, we measured teams in the act of creation. We asked them all kinds of questions. We asked them about stimulus, and we asked them about fear, and we asked them about the diversity of the group, and different things. And literally, stimulus diversity loaded in exponential when it came to explaining the number of meaningful, unique ideas invented by the teams. And we did it like three different ways. We did it longitudinally, vertically, horizontally, and we tracked people over time. And there's a whole multiple collection of studies that we did on it. And so it truly is exponential. That's not just me saying it. It truly is. Mm-hmm. Now, that diversity is all of the diversities. My team says it's the silo diversities that are the biggest blockage. They're right on that. To me, long term, the biggest bang is when you get these cultural diversities. That's the real value.
Okay.
But it's a fact. It's a fact. And that's the potential. Stimulus and diversity is your potential. Divided by the level of fear, we asked the question, for whatever reason, I didn't say all ideas that came to mind. And when that question went up, the number of ideas went down. Huh. They literally held back from talking. We created less ideas.
All right.
We literally track the sessions, average them out, look at them over time, and you would have less ideas from a group that was like that. Okay. I mean, this is a factual point. I mean, it's just – it's reality. All and right. It's confirmed by other research.
This is the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy podcast, where we will take you behind the scenes so you can see what it takes to build a whiskey distillery business. The Eureka Ranch team, led by Doug Hall, are creating a craft whiskey company with patented technology like has never been done before. Okay, let's move to the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy. So, you know, we've talked before, Doug, about this, the concept of thinkers and doers and leveraging diversity. How does this play out in a whiskey distillery? What's going on with that?
Okay, so, you know, I've talked about thinkers and doers and the need for collaboration so that we don't become like the McCoys and the Hatfields, you know. We got to come together. The problem is that, creating a distillery takes money. And so oftentimes we get investors or different people involved in it, and they've been successful in the business world. And the way they know how to do things is to set up organizational charts and departments and allocate who does what things. I mean, that's just what they know. Right. That's what they know. And so, you know, as the company gets going for efficiency purposes, you just do your job, you do your job, and somehow magically all the connections will work together. Now, that's when it's run by a corporate person. When it's run by a true entrepreneur, somebody who started up companies, you know, many of them, like I started my first one at age 12, I started doing things, I've been doing it forever. You don't tend to have that. You tend to have more of a collaborative community. And while everybody will have maybe a job they do, they all have a blend of knowledge about everything else. And in fact, what I found is like if you sort of magically showed up at the distillery, which is in the former garage of the Eureka Ranch, just west of the ranch, and there was a meeting going on here, you would hear somebody talking about, say, we're working on a new idea for a new product. Somebody might be talking about packaging. Another one would be talking about supply chain. Can we get the wood? Then somebody else might be talking about the economics as to what it do. Another person may be turning around and saying, okay, so if I was to pitch this to a bar, here's what I would say. And you would hear everybody doing it. And the same person that talked marketing would suddenly be talking about product. Okay.
Yeah.
And you'd have a hard time figuring out who did what. You might figure it out, but it would be pretty hard to figure out who's doing what because everybody's involved in all of the decisions. And that's not to say that we debate to compromise, but because at the end of the day, as a leader, it's my job to make the final decision and they respect that. But they've all been heard and we've all debated it. And most important of all, when somebody feels really strongly about it, I never make the call. We just run a test. We just run a test. I mean, we had a debate recently on some of our products, on the next generation of products. And finally I said, screw it. Let's just run the test. We ran the test and found out one of them, yes, we should change it. The other one, no, it wasn't a good idea. Hmm. Just ran a quantitative test, ran it that night, had the data. And so even when you're wrong, the facts are there. And so everybody feels like, yeah, I've got a voice in this. I've got a voice in this. And so when you're building your distillery, you've got to set up from the beginning to get people to understand. I know you've got somebody who's just running the stills. Fine. But they got to know how to sell the stuff too. And the people that are out front who are selling in your tasting room have got to understand how the product's actually made. And they've got to understand the math and the consequences associated with different decisions, or else you're only going to use a part of their brain. If you want to get them fully engaged, they've got to know more. So you got to help them understand.
So is it, you said as a CEO, you make the decision, but the people don't feel like they're being stepped on from a standpoint of coming up with an idea or something like that, because you've built in to the system saying, okay, if we, you know, And I don't know what the determining factors are. Maybe somebody feels strongly, even though everybody else disagrees with them. Then your action then is to say, well, let's run a test.
Yeah, most of the time.
Okay.
Most of the time when it – or it doesn't – now, there are exceptions.
Okay.
There are exceptions. Legality issues.
All right.
Regulatory issues, mm-hmm. where there's financial or legal exposure. I'm sorry, that's not negotiable. Okay, those are facts. We never have ethical issues because that's just not the type of team. In some organizations, there might be ethical issues, but we just don't have that because that's not the way we are. But there are certain times when there's decisions where the leader has to make it, and even when there's consequences. It's like we had a product where, you know, when it's mission focused, you know, we had a product that was okay. It was okay. It was okay. It was good. Some of our partners wanted to do it. It was okay. And I turned around and I looked at the test data and it was close. It was okay. And I finally said to the team, I said, anybody proud of this product? They go, no, it's okay. I said, then screw it. Let's not do it. Let's blow it up. And so we blew it up and I said, make something that you're proud of. I don't want to sell crappy product. I said, that's my new standard. Don't sell crappy product. And of course, everybody laughed.
That's a and low thought, bar there.
Damn, that's kind of a cool concept. Only going to do stuff you're proud of, and we're not going to sell crap. Yeah, that's a good concept. Now, the problem is in the spirits business, there's many people selling. The number one, the Craft Whiskey Association did a survey of bartenders and said, what's your advice to craft spirits things? And the number one thing they said was, you got to make better quality products. And because aging takes so long, they sell the products too soon and they just ruin their reputation and the products are just not very good. Now that's why our time compression is helpful to them, because they can sell time compression products and they can build a nice business there. And in addition to, not in place of, our products can be like their, you know, their volume products, the specialty products, allow people to make their own custom whiskey, while their products, you know, classically aged, can be like their single malts, as in their, you know, their premium expression. And I can buy them the time that enables them to be able to wait the appropriate time to make the product actually wonderful.
So Doug, let me just for people like me that I don't consider myself necessarily, you know, a complete novice, but at the same time, when you say single malt, for somebody listening that may be new to to some of the language, maybe they drink whiskey, but, you know, they see single malt, what does that mean?
So that would be a product that's made generally. So this legal definition in Scotland, a single malt is one distillery, one grain, generally barley. Okay.
Okay.
And now in the U.S., there's a work going on by the craft folks, which I encourage, which is to get single malt an official category. Right now, it's fanciful marketing words. When you say single malt barley whiskey is a category of product. Single malt is sort of marketing puffery because it's not regulated yet, and creating that standard here so that we can do single malt just like they do in Scotland and in other places. You can do it now. It's just not an official category.
Okay. Okay. So there's a difference than the way Scotland does it.
Yeah. And I'll be honest with you. While I love Scotch whiskey, I love Highland Park, I love Macallan. No question. When I went to the North Pole, you know, and at the end of the North Pole, what do you drink? You drink Highland Park 18. Okay. My favorite classic whiskey in the world by far. And I'm a zealot for it. That said, if you want creative and amazing new tastes, it is much easier to make them if you're a whiskey, not a bourbon, which has rules with it, not a rye, not a wheat, not a corn, not a barley, but your whiskey, as in you have a mixture of those, just like Bordeaux wine is a mixture of three grapes, or Meritage is from California. Mm. Some of the most expensive wines in the world are blends of different grapes. So too, I think what you're going to see long-term on whiskey is that it's going to be these different grains put together in unique ways in different whiskeys that are going to be what the great whiskeys are going to be in the long term. Long term. There'll always be a place for the single things, but you can just do more amazing things when you start to use different ingredients.
Okay, very good. Well, let's move to our craft cocktail recipe, the Boulevard cocktail. Now, how does, I'm always curious to know how you come up with these cocktails to fit in with the theme of the episode that we're doing. So how does the Boulevard cocktail fit into all the things we're talking about?
Well, this was interesting because as I was texting last night before we recorded, I was looking through Dale DeGroff's classic book, The Craft of the Cocktail. And Dale DeGroff was Windows of the World, New York. I had the blessings to spend an entire day with him on a project. And we spent the morning tasting a collection of different whiskeys that we had and messing with some things. And then he took us on a tour of speakeasies in different places in New York and did his flaming orange peel, which I'll talk about in a minute. And he's a legend. He's a legend in the business and as wonderful a person as you hope he would be. Hmm. I've had an opportunity to meet many celebrities. We won't talk about the bad ones, but there are some like Charles Schulz of Peanuts and Jim Henson of the Muppets and Dale DeGroff who are just genuinely, they're kind of awesome people that you'd love to just hang out with. Forget the fact that they're famous. They're just good people. And Dale is definitely one of those. And he cites this cocktail coming from a Selmer Fogner in the New York Sun of 1935. So I think it was an article that he found that he cited. And it just struck me as something different. It was a little different. And I noticed that I could see the DNA in this. And that this cocktail, which I'd never had before, I just made it literally last night. It has hints of an old fashioned because there's some orange that comes from Grand Marnier. Mm-hmm. And hints of a Manhattan from vermouth. So that's pretty weird, okay? I mean, I'm taking two of the classic cocktails, the old fashioned and the Manhattan, and kind of doing like a jazz riff on these things here, putting them together. And I thought, geez, I wonder, it just struck me as, what the hell is this? I never heard of this thing from 1935. And I made it and I went, damn, that's quite a cocktail. So the way it works is this, and again, in the show notes, we've got the details. 2 ounces of rye whiskey. I use our own rye whiskey, but, get a good craft rye whiskey. 1/2 ounce of Grand Marnier, which is an orange liqueur. 1/2 ounce of dry vermouth, which I tend to use Dolan just because I like Dolan. And then and you stir it with ice and strain into a chilled glass. And then here's the Dale DeGroff twist on it, which is you put a flamed orange peel. Now, you can go on the internet and just search for it. And you can see some videos of it being done. You can learn how to do it. But I'll just explain it quickly. What you do is just you take the orange and you cut just a sliver of the peel off, usually in a bit of an oblong oval shape. Then you hold it about 4 inches above the glass from the sides, the short parts to it. So if it's an oval, you're going to hold the sides to it with the skin side towards the drink. Okay, the skin towards the drink. Mm-hmm. Then you light a lighter, match, torch, whatever. I like to use like a barbecue torch so to keep my fingers away from it. And get the fire going first. And then you sort of squeeze the peel. And what happens is the oils shoot out and you get this flame. And just a real quick flame, and then you drop the peel into the glass. And so what it does is there's a caramelization that happens in the flame and a little tiny bit of smoke. And it just puts a unique orange zest, if you would, in the drink. And it's quite nice. Quite nice, actually.
Very good. So how does this fit into what we talked about?
Well, it's the same thing. It's the bringing together of the thinkers and the doers. In this case here, I'm bringing together. Didn't see that, did you?
No. Okay. I knew it is in there somewhere. I just had to reach for it.
The old fashioned and the Manhattan, and it's bringing them together in this taste, which is not an old fashioned and it's not a Manhattan. It's like if a Manhattan and an old fashioned got together, this is what they would give birth to. In a bizarre way, I guess.
All right. And what is your rye whiskey again?
Well,
that you guys make.
yeah, we're about to introduce one, which is called Deckhand, the working man's rye, and Deckhand. It's made with five woods. So it's a big brass. So it's, again, the story is that on the riverboats, there were the deckhands, and these were the ones that would work the poles to help the boats when they were floating down, whether they were keel boats or flat boats. And these were the working men. And they would like to have that heartier drink. You know, when they had one, they wanted a full impact. Similar to the bar staff. The bar staff, oftentimes, the working men there, they like the ryes, which tend to be a little higher in alcohol, a little bit more spice, a little bit more robustness. And so what we did here was we took the – with Deckhand, the working man's rye, what we've done is we've taken the rye, a 95% rye, and then we finished it with five woods. We used American oak, young American oak. We used 200-year oak like we use in keelboat and paddle wheel. We used European sherry oak, and then we added some maple and some apple wood. And so we take the five woods, and interestingly, on the back of the package, we talk about mash bill, 95% rye, but we also talk about wood bill and talk about show the percentages of the five woods that we're using in the finishing process. And the net result is you get just, I mean, the first thing somebody says when they taste it, they go, my God, there's a lot going on there. and it's just got a lot of complexity and robustness, the kind of taste you would get from a much older, bigger whiskey that was maybe bottled at even a higher proof, at barrel proof, much bigger taste. And so it makes spectacular whiskey-forward cocktails. And amongst the, you know, rye is to whiskey as IPA is to beer. You know, it's that more intense, and you either love it or you don't.
Right.
But in our case here, we've taken it way up over the top. There's other ryes that you can get out there. Ours just happens to have much more complexity and much more, and it just celebrates the working man who made the boats go. Before there were motors and paddle wheels, there were these guys with poles helping push the boat off the shore when it got caught up and making it go.
Okay. And is, did you say Deckhand is available some places yet, or is in the process?
It's available. We're very close. So sometimes it'll be available at the distillery, and then we'll decide where to go. Our products are really made as demonstrations because we're partnering with distilleries around the world.
Yeah.
Who we use these as inspiration to show them how to create their own business, their own brands. So these are really sort of, if you were, prototypes to show them, you know, as we're doing it. But our business is helping other whiskey makers or wannabe whiskey makers make more money.
I got it. Okay. Yeah. Well, that makes sense. And
so we walk the talk. We also do it ourselves.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you shouldn't listen to me helping you do better.
Come up with your own, damn it. So Deckhand, the price range will be that $35 price that you're looking at?
And up at $39. Rye is more expensive. Going to try to stay to $35, but I might be $37 or $39. I've got to – again, we're working the math to see if we can get some efficiencies. But it's at a higher percent alcohol, usually 46, 48% alcohol instead of 40 or 45. So – that costs us more money in tax and the rest of that stuff. So I'd like to keep to 35 because I'd like the line to stay at 35, but I got to look at the total math on it. It's not going over 40. I can tell you that.
Okay.
The only question is do we have to push it up a little bit more to make the math work?
Okay. All right. Very good. Another interesting episode. Next time ran out of time to do it this time, but we do need to get an update on your distillery. So we'll do that when we kick off the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy the next episode.
Well, it'll be perfect because that should be just before the opening of the distillery. So we're very, very close, and I think the next episode will be airing just before the distillery opening.
Very good. All right. Thank you, Doug.
The expansion of the distillery.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Because we appreciate you as a listener, we are offering for a limited time four things. A 1 hour abridged audio of the Driving Eureka book. A subscription to the Driving Eureka newsletter, which contains weekly advice from Doug Hall on how to find, filter, and fast track big ideas. And the newsletter has other offers that are not made public. The Driving Eureka prescription for success: you answer questions and we'll help you assess your ability to find, filter, and fast track big ideas. And you get advice on how to grow your ability to innovate. And the last item, access to a Doug Hall interview with a radio legend. To get these offers, go to www.doughall.com/podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to the Driving Eureka podcast on iTunes.